The Devil's Arithmetic, Disc 4.
Chapter 13. Hannah woke to a strange mechanical bellowing. For a moment she thought it was the clock radio by her bed. She sat up suddenly and hit her head with a loud crack on the shelf above her. Stunned, she looked around. Clock radio? The words sat lumpily in her mind. She wasn't sure what a clock radio was. Besides, her head hurt when she'd banged it, and her back ached from lying on the hard shelf. Even her leg hurt. She drew her knee up to look. There was caked blood and a big scab along her shin. Then she remembered. The trip in the cattle car. The long, hungry days. The heat and the cold. The smell. The dead baby. The tattoo. The shorn hair. Cautiously, she reached up and felt her head. What hair was left was a stubble. She didn't dare look at the number on her arm. Swinging her legs carefully over the side of the shelf, she eased herself onto the floor, aware that the bellowing horn had stopped. Others in the barracks were performing the same slow unfolding. She looked around, her eyes and mind still fuzzed with sleep. The door to the barracks was flung open, and a guard stuck his head in. "If you want food, get in line. Now, schnell, you must eat. Hungry Jews are dead Jews. Dead Jews do not work." Food, Hannah whispered to herself, and the dream she'd had came back to her. All that Seder food and the familiar faces around the table, faces she could almost, but not quite, name. She imagined the taste of the roast beef, and saliva filled her mouth. Standing, she smoothed down the wrinkled skirt of her dress and looked around for Gittel. Gittel was bending over one of the lowest shelves. Hannah recognized her by the awful red print dress. Hurrying over, Hannah called out,
"Food, Gittel! They'll give us food, if we hurry, at last!"
Gittel stood up slowly and stared past Hannah to the door, as if she didn't see her. Her mouth whispered something, but no sound came out, and her hands clenched and unclenched into fists. Something forced Hannah to bend down and stare into the shelf. Little Tzipora lay curled in a ball, her finger in her mouth like a stopper in a bottle. There was a fly on her cheek. Hannah reached out to brush it off.
"Don't touch her,"
Gittel said. "But..." Hannah's hand hovered over the child's cheek and the fly that would not leave.
"I said don't touch her!"
Gittel's voice was strangely hoarse. Hannah still reached toward the fly, unbelieving, and Gittel grabbed her hand, spinning her around. She slapped Hannah's face twice.
"Do not slap. Touch her. Slap."
Then, as suddenly, she put her arms around Hannah with such force Hannah gasped. Gittel buried her face against Hannah's shoulder, sobbing,
"Yitzchak, what will I say? Tzipora, he must be told. What can I..." "Monsters!"
It was all Hannah could do to free her arms enough so that she could pat Gittel's shorn head, touching it with as much tenderness as she could muster, while her cheeks still burned from the unwarranted slaps. They were the last ones out of the barracks. Even Fega had managed to get onto the proper food line before them, with the help of one of the women from her village. Emerging from the building, blinking into the noon sun, Hannah saw that Gittel's eyes were dry, but they still held a reserve of some awful, unspoken anger. The line moved quickly, silently. At the first table, a girl handed them each a metal bowl. Plain-faced, with a broad forehead and deep-set brown eyes. She greeted them with a smile, as if they were old friends. Hannah guessed she couldn't have been more than 10 years old, yet her face seemed ageless. "You must take good care of your bow," the girl said to them. It was obvious she had recited these same words to each group of newcomers, yet her voice held a sweetness and a patience quite out of keeping with the information she delivered. "I call them every bowls because they are everything to us. Without the bowl, you cannot have food, you cannot wash, you cannot drink. Memorize your bowl, its dents, its shape. Always know where you have put it. There are no replacements." She winked at Hannah. "That's the official speech. My mother, may she rest in peace, used to give it, and now I take her place. If you meet me tonight after supper, I will tell you the rest. And if you cannot find me, ask anyone for Rivka. Rivka!" Too exhausted to react, Hannah nodded and held up her bowl for its dipperful of watery potato soup. At the next table, she was given a small slab of dark bread. She began to eat even before she left the line. She was too hungry to eat slowly, and the soup and bread were gone before she had time to look around. After the meal, the Tsugangi were lined up again in what seemed to Hannah to be a totally arbitrary order, orchestrated by the same three-fingered woman. She dealt out slaps and pushes with such fervor that they all did her bidding without protest. Hannah managed to dodge a slap. The slap meant for her hit Shifa, who cried out in pain and was hit again for the noise. Hannah bent her shoulders over against Shifra's muffled sobbing, guilty because she had been the cause of it, relieved because the blow hadn't fallen upon her. When they were lined up to the women's satisfaction, she nodded abruptly and walked to the front to address them. "You wonder what to expect from now on?" she asked. "I will tell you what to expect. Hard work, that's what. Hard work, and more hard work. And punishment if you do not perform well and on time, without complaints." Her speech was short enough that Hannah took a deep breath in relief. She was just starting to relax when a man in a dark uniform, jangling with medals, walked over to the woman. The woman bowed her head and then looked up at the gathering of prisoners, smiling an awful warning. Standing for a long moment, hands behind his back, the officer silently surveyed them. Hannah felt as if he were looking deep inside her, totting up her abilities, guessing at her chances. Someone else she knew stood that way. Mr. Unsward. She had the name and could almost see him in her mind's eye, but she couldn't remember who he was. Only that he was someone who stood up in front of a group and shook his head just like that. She wondered if she should smile at the officer and whether it might help. Sometimes it worked in school. With Mr. Unsward. In school. There. She had it, an elusive slip of memory. Then, as quickly, it faded, replaced by another, much more vivid memory. Little Tsipora, lying still on the low shelf, her finger corked so finely in her mouth. That image stopped any chance of a smile. The officer cleared his throat. "You will have discipline," he said suddenly, without preamble. "You will work hard. You will never answer back, complain, or question. You will not try to escape. You will do this for the fatherland. You will do it, or you will die." The officer turned smartly on his heel and left. Then the three-fingered woman came forward to tell them about the work that lay ahead, and what they were to expect each day. Above them, a quartet of swallows dipped and circled, twittering madly as they plunged after insects. There was a drone of machinery somewhere off to the right. In the distance, beyond another long row of barracks, Hannah could see a single strand of smoke rising against the bright spring sky, curling endlessly out of a tall chimney stack. Once again it occurred to her that there was something she wasn't remembering, something terribly important to her, to all of them. She wondered if Gittel would know what it was, and resolved to ask her. But the raucous swallows, the woman's droning commands, the ground bass of the machinery mesmerized her. She could feel her eyelids starting to close. To stop herself from falling asleep on her feet, she threw her head back suddenly and took a deep breath. Out of the corner of her eye, she glimpsed Gittel. Then, without moving her head farther, only her eyes, she managed to find Fage. She was standing halfway down the line, her face paper white and her eyes fully closed. She swayed where she stood. Behind her was Esther, and beside Esther was Shifra, her lashless eyes even stranger looking under the shaved head. Hannah remembered them, remembered each and everything they had said to her in the forest. She remembered the forest, and remembered she'd told them stories. But the stories, those she couldn't remember, and it bothered her that she couldn't. She'd seen men running to get into a line behind them during the first moments of the assembly, but she hadn't dared turn around then. Even now she was afraid to look. Would Shmuel be there? Yitzhak? Would Rabbi Baruch? The Balchen? The members of the Klezmer band? Would Mr. Unsward? Gittel, she whispered out of the side of her mouth, low enough so that the woman in blue couldn't hear her.
Gittel.
Gittel touched her hand. Chaya, she whispered back, so fiercely it sounded like a promise or a command. Chapter 14. That evening, after another meal of watery soup and a small piece of bread, the girl, Rivka, found Hannah. She already had Esther and Shifra in tow. The other two girls looked as uneasy as Hannah felt, out in the open, with the watchtowers spaced every 100 feet along the barbed wire fences staring down at them. "Don't be afraid," Rivka said quickly. "We have little to fear in the night. Any choosing is done during the day. They don't run the gas at night. They let us out for an hour each evening for enforced recreation. If you are alive now, this minute, it is enough."
"What do you mean it's enough?" Esther said, her voice rising in pitch. "My father is missing. My grandmother died on that train. I can't find any of my aunts. Yenta and Rachel are gone."
Rivka shook her head sadly. "I have been here a year, and in that time, my mother and my sisters, my father and brother, have gone there." She pointed to the far smokestack. "My mother because she was coughing too badly to work. My sisters, three younger than me, because they wouldn't leave her side. My father and my brother Saul, because they were too angry, too strong, too outspoken. Now, my brother Wolf is left, but he is a Sonderkommando, one of the walking dead. He might as well be with them. We all have such stories. It is a brutal arithmetic. But I am alive. You are alive. As long as we breathe, we can see and hear. As long as we can remember, all those gone before are alive inside us." Esther started to turn away, but Rivka caught her arm. "Listen to me, please. You must listen if you wish to stay alive. I know the things you need to know in this place. There is the Malach HaMavis, the angel of death, hovering overhead. But we can fool him if we follow the rules.
"Who are you to tell us anything?" Shifra asked. "What makes you an authority?"
"This is my authority," Rivka said sternly, holding up her arm so that the number showed. J18202. J because I am, like you, a Jew. The one is for me, because I am alone. The eight is for my family, because there were eight of us when we lived in our village. And the two, because that is all that are left now. Me and Wolf, who believes himself to be a zero. But I love him no matter what he is forced to do. And when we are free, and this is over, we will be two again. God will allow it.
God is not here, Hannah said. The Balchen was right. This is the devil's place.
God made the devil. So God is here too, Rivka said.
Pilpul, a man's game, Shifra said.
Rivka smiled. I play the man's game. I play the devil's game. I play God's game. And so I stay alive. Alive, I can help you. Dead, I am no help to you at all.
Without meaning to, Hannah smiled back.
Good, Rivka said, nodding. If you smile, you will stay alive.
Then tell us, Rivka, about all these rules, Hannah said.
First, you may call me Rivka, and I may call you by your names. But remember my number as you remember your own. You must learn to read the numbers as you would a name. There are good numbers and bad numbers.
What do you mean? Shifra asked.
Esther walked away from them, shaking her head and humming loudly as if to drown out the sound of Rivka's voice.
Esther? Shifra called.
Leave her, said Rivka. Leave her. Sometimes people get like that. They stop listening. They stop seeing. It's as if they decide that life is not worth fighting for. We call them Muslimen. It is sad. Very sad. I will be sorry if your friend chooses that, but if she does, I will let her. And you must let her as well.
Shifra nodded.
I understand.
I don't, Hannah said. You can't just let her go.
You will have to, Rivka said. It is one of the hard things you must do to stay alive. To let people go. To know when to fight and when not to. To know who to talk to and who to avoid. Listen, never stand next to someone with a G in her number. She is a Greek, and Greeks do not speak Yiddish and do not understand German. Greek Jews disappear quickly.
They become these Muslimen?
Shifra asked.
They become gone, Rivka answered.
Because they don't understand commands fast enough. They don't react fast enough. Anyone standing next to them may be gone with them. Sent off to Lilith's cave alongside a Greek.
And here is another rule.
Those aren't rules, Hannah argued.
Those are crazinesses.
Nevertheless, you must learn them, Rivka said. See my number? It's lower than yours. Someone with a number like mine has been here a long time. We are survivors. We can tell you things. Read the numbers. My lower number tells you I can organize things.
Organize? Hannah shook her head.
What do you mean?
Organize, Rivka said. As I have organized some shoes for you, and not wooden clogs either. And sweaters. You will need them because the nights are cold still. And if you need medicines, though we have few of them, even in the hospital, and you don't want to go there if you can help it, you must find Sarah the Lubliner. J11177. She works in the sorting shed, and sometimes she can organize ointments from the pockets of coats or valises. And sometimes pills. I think some bandages, too, though you can wear them only where no one can see, or Sarah would be in trouble. The commandant likes her. She was a singer in Lublin, in the cafes.
He has her sing at supper time when he visits. Hannah and Shifra stared at Rivka as she rattled on. It was like a waterfall of information, Hannah thought. How could she take it all in and be safe? And you must never go near that, Rivka said, turning suddenly and pointing way across the compound to a large wooden fence. There was a black, handleless door. Beyond the fence loomed the smokestack.
We call that the door to Lilith's cave, the cave of Death's Bride. If you go through that door, you don't come out again.
Lilith, Hannah muttered as if remembering a story. But the most important thing for you to know is the midden, Rivka said.
The garbage dump?
Shifra and Hannah asked together. Yes.
Commandant Breuer is not supposed to allow children under 14 in the camp. So whenever he comes to inspect things, the children have to disappear. What he doesn't see doesn't exist. The best hiding place is in the midden. None of the Germans go there. It is beneath them. Oh, they know the children are hiding in it, of course, but they pretend it's too dirty, too disgusting, so they don't look. Even Breuer really knows.
We have to go into the midden? Hannah was clearly shocked.
Not us. We look old enough. I am only 10, but everybody thinks I am older. And you two can surely pass. You have...
She motioned toward her own undeveloped chest.
So we don't have to be dumped. But it is our duty to help the little ones.
The Germans are right, Shifra said. It is disgusting.
Disgusting? Garbage can be paradise, Rivka said.
One of my sisters couldn't run fast enough to disappear into the midden sanctuary. They sent her with my mother right through the door into Lilith's cave. I can still hear her calling to me to save her, to hide her.
Hannah suddenly heard a child's voice, as if from far away, saying,
Hannah, look where I hid...
She couldn't think who the child was, or who Hannah was. Her head hurt with trying to remember.
She went on the line and was gone, Rivka finished.
Hannah stared at Rivka. What line?
The line. The one drawn by the Malach HaMavis, the angel of death. The one into...
Her face pale, her coffee-colored eyes unreadable. Rivka stopped. Hannah nodded slowly, suddenly sure of one thing, as if she had known it all her life. Into the gas ovens, she whispered.
Oh, Chaya, not another one of your stories, Shifra said, her eyes wide and full of fear.
Rivka led them to her own barracks, three buildings away from the place where the Tsugangi were housed. There were names carved on the bunks, and magazine advertisements stuck onto nails in the walls, as if the women had tried to personalize the place, but it didn't help. These barracks were as starkly unwelcoming as theirs. From under her sleeping shelf, Rivka pulled out a pile of shoes. Quickly she sorted through them until she found three pairs, two of which matched exactly, and a third that was at least the same size and style, though one shoe was dark maroon and the other brown. The shoes were badly scuffed and worn through at the toes, but wearable.
I hope these fit, or at least are close enough. Why don't they give us back our own shoes? Hannah asked.
Because the good shoes get sent to Germany, Rivka said. But one does not ask why here.
Another rule?
Hannah asked.
And a good one, Rivka said. It is better not to know some things.
Knowing the wrong things can make you crazy.
No stockings? Shifra said.
You're lucky to have real shoes, Rivka answered. And not just clogs. When I got here, I had to run around for months on wooden clogs my mother carved for me.
Wooden shoes? Hannah said.
Rivka smiled. Never mind. I shall keep trying for better shoes for all of us. She looked down at her own shoes. The right was so badly worn at the heel, her foot showed through. At least now it is spring, and we have time to look. Last month was bad. There was snow and frost. Masha from Krakow, J16689, lost 2 toes, and there were many cases of frostbite. Bad cases. Bad enough to go to the hospital. The Dark Angel goes there first. You're lucky.
Lucky? Hannah muttered.
Yes, lucky, Rivka said, sounding as if she were beginning to lose patience. We count our luck with a different measure here in the camp.
Shifra stared silently at the shoes she held in her hand, but Hannah shook her head slowly over and over.
Now tell me your names.
Shifra,
Rivka nodded.
Chaya,
Hannah whispered, the name sounding strange in her mouth, foreign. Then she bit her lip and, remembering Rivka's explanation, held up her arm.
And also, J for Jew, and one for me, alone. I am very, very much alone. And 9 is for... Well, in English it's pronounced 9, which is like the German word for no. No, I will not die here. Not now. Not in my sleep, like little children.
How do you know English? Shifra asked. Did you learn it in your school in Lublin?
You went to school? Rivka asked, a kind of awe in her voice.
No, yes,
I don't remember, Hannah said, surprised at the whine in her voice. Rivka put her hand out, touching Hannah gently on the arm, stroking the number with 2 fingers ever so gently. It happens sometimes. We forget because remembering is so painful. But memory will return when you're ready for it.
Go on, Chaya. Jay... 1, 9?
Hannah nodded.
J1, 9, 7. 7 is for each and every day of the week I stay alive. 1 day at a time. Then 2 for Gittel and Shmuel, who are here in this place too.
Her aunt and uncle, Shifra added. She's living with them.
Was living with them. And 4 for...
She stopped, closed her eyes, and thought a minute. 4 was such a comforting number, a familiar number, a family number. She wasn't sure why.
And 4 is for my family, I think. I almost remember them. If I close my eyes, they're there, hovering within sight. But when I open my eyes, they're gone.
It happens, Rivka said. Her parents died of cholera in Lublin. It was a great tragedy, Tante Gittel said,
Shifra volunteered.
But maybe...
She looked around the barracks.
Maybe it was a great blessing.
No, Hannah said suddenly.
No, not them. Not in Lublin. Not those parents. At least not exactly.
This time it was Shifra who put her hand on Hannah's arm, though she spoke to Rivka.
Don't mind her ramblings. She was terribly sick before she came to live with Gittel and Shmuel. Once the doctors thought she'd died, but they brought her back. She was in the hospital for weeks. She says odd things.
And 1,
Hannah continued, as if she'd never been interrupted,
because I am all alone. Here, in this place. In this time.
She ended triumphantly, though part of her wondered what she'd meant.
Chaya says she will live, Rivka said to Shifra.
Wherever else her mind may wander, she has said it. I hope she means it.
And now, Shifra, tell me your number in the same way. It'll help us both remember. After that, we will find your other friend.
Esther? But you said she was hopeless.
Esther, she is not a Muslim yet. There is still hope for her.
But if she does not get her shoes and sweater and a lesson in camp manners, She will not be long for even this world, I tell you.
But they couldn't find Esther in the short hour before they were herded back into the barracks. Schifre took the mismatched shoes for her, and Hannah the sweater. And then they entered the Zugangi barracks with the others for the first long night in camp. Hannah slipped uneasily into sleep, with the sounds of 70 women around her. Some of them were noisy sleepers, punctuating their dreams with snores. One or two cried out sharply in their sleep, and one woman wept throughout the night. Low, horrible sobs that rose in pitch until someone got up and comforted her. Then she would begin her sobbing again, slowly gathering volume and strength. Hannah's dreams were filled with the sobs, but in the dreams there were cries of joy. She dreamed she was in a schoolyard where girls in blue dresses and blue pants with brightly colored sweaters hooked arms and laughed, shutting her out from their group. When she woke, she was crying. Her upper arms, which had served as her pillow, were wet. The sweater she had used for a blanket had slipped to the floor. She couldn't remember the dream. Chapter 15. In the morning, after roll call and breakfast were over, they got their first lesson at the midden. "Commandant," a man called across the wire fence from the men's camp. "Commandant coming," a woman took up the cry. "He is coming," Rivka said urgently to Hannah and Schifre, who were standing near the cauldrons, where they had been helping dish out the watery soup. "Do what I do." Rivka put her hands up to her mouth as if shouting, but instead made a penetrating clucking noise by placing her tongue against the roof of her mouth. From all over the camp came the same clicking, as if crazed crickets had invaded the place. The small children, alerted by the sound, came scrambling from everywhere. They raced toward the midden heap behind the barracks. Even the camp guards joined in, alternately clucking and laughing, waving the children on toward the garbage pile. The largest children carried the littlest ones in their arms. There were about 30 in all. Hannah watched, amazed at their speed. When they got to the midden, they skinned out of their clothes and dove naked into the dump. Suddenly, Hannah noticed that one of the camp babies was still cradled in a washtub. Without stopping to ask, she grabbed it up and ran with the child into the middle of the midden. Garbage slipped along her bare legs. She waded through a mixture of old rags, used bandages, the emptied-out waste of the slop buckets. The midden smell was overwhelming. Though she'd already gotten used to the pervasive camp smell, a cloudy musk that seemed to hang over everything, a mix of sweat and fear and sickness, and the ever-present smoke that stained the sky. The smell in the midden was worse. She closed her eyes and lowered herself into the garbage, the baby clutched in her arms. When the all-clear clucking finally came, Hannah emerged from the heap with the baby, who was cooing. She scrubbed them both off with a rag until the child's mother, Leah, came running over.
"I will murder that Eliu Krupnik. Where is he? He's supposed to take her in. And look, you left her clothes on. They're filthy."
Leah's face was contorted with anger. "No thanks," Rivka asked.
"Leah, she saved the baby."
Leah stared for a moment at Hannah, as if seeing her for the first time. Then, as if making an effort, she smiled.
"I will organize some water," she said,
leaving the filthy baby in Hannah's filthy arms.
"That means thank you," Rivka said.
Hannah stared after Leah.
"I think," she said slowly, "I think I prefer the water to the thanks."
That night, she washed out her dress with the cup of water, hanging it like a curtain from her sleeping shelf. Now she understood why the children had all stripped off their clothes, dropping them like bright rags on the sandy ground.
She'd worried that the clothing would be gaudy signals to the commandant. But clearly he already knew, as did the guards, where the children hid. It was all some kind of awful game. But she'd been too scared to stop and too shy to undress out in the open like that, especially while the memory of her naked hours waiting for the shower still brought a blush to her face. Especially as the guards, some in their late teens, had all been laughing nearby. As she fell asleep, she was sure the smell of the midden had gotten into her pores, that there was not enough water in the camp, in all of Poland, to wash her clean. The days quickly became routine. Roll call, breakfast, work, lunch, work, supper, work. The meals were all watery potato soup, and occasionally bread, hard and crusty. Then they had a precious hour before they were locked in their barracks for the night. The work was the mindless sort. Some of it was meant to keep the camp itself running, cleaning the barracks, the guards' houses, the hospital, the kitchen, cutting and hauling wood for the stoves, building more barracks, more privies. But most of the workers were used in the sorting sheds, stacking the clothing and suitcases and possessions stolen from the prisoners, dividing them into piles to be sent back to Germany. Still, Hannah was glad of the routine. As long as she knew what to expect, she wasn't frightened. What was more frightening was the unknown. The occasional corpse hanging on the gate without an explanation. The swift kick by the Blokova for no reason. She and Shifra were set to work with Rivka in the kitchen, hauling water in large buckets from the pump, spooning out the meager meals, washing the giant cauldrons in which the soup cooked, scrubbing the walls and floors. It was hard work, harder than Hannah could ever remember doing. Her hands and knees held no memory of such work. It was endless and repetitive. But it wasn't without its rewards. Occasionally they were able to scrape out an extra bit of food for themselves and the little ones while cleaning the pots, burned pieces of potatoes that had stuck to the bottom. Even burnt pieces tasted wonderful, better even than beef. She thought she remembered beef. She gave the Blokova a gold ring she organized to get you in here, Leia explained, wiping her hands on a rag and nodding her head in Rivka's direction. Leia was the head of the kitchen crew. Her arms were always splotchy and stained. But it was a good job, for she could keep her baby with her. Otherwise, that one, and she spit on the ground to show her disapproval of the three-fingered woman, she would have had you hauling wood with the men. And you would never have lasted, because you are a city girl. It is in your hands. Not a country girl like Shifra. We outlast you every time. When Hannah tried to thank Rivka, the girl only smiled and shrugged away the thanks. My mother, may she rest in peace, always said, a nemer is nicht kein geber. A taker is not a giver, and a giver is not a taker either. Keep your thanks, and hand it on. She said it gently, as if embarrassed. Hannah understood her embarrassment and didn't mention it again, but she did try to pass it on. She began saving the softer insides of the bread, slipping it to Reuven when she could. Yitzhak's little boy was so thin and sad-looking, still wondering where his sister had gone, that she couldn't resist him. She even tried giving him her whole bread, meal after meal, until Gittel found out. "You cannot help the child by starving yourself," Gittel said. "Besides, with those big blue eyes, he'll have many to help him. And that smile." Hannah bit her lip. Those big blue eyes and the luminous, infrequent smiles reminded her of someone else she couldn't name. "But you are still a growing girl, Chaya. You must take care of you." She folded Hannah's hands around the bread and pushed her away from Reuven. "Go finish your kitchen duties. I will take Reuven with me." Hannah turned away reluctantly, as if she had somehow failed Rivka. As she did so, she saw that Gittel had given the child her own bread, and have her suit besides. It was on the third day in the camp that Commandant Breuer came again. This time, word was whispered around the camp for a choosing. His black car drove right up the middle of the camp, between the rows of barracks, the flag on the aerial snapping merrily. The driver got out, opened the rear door, and stood at attention. "What is a choosing?" Hannah asked Rivka out of the side of her mouth, as they waited beside the cauldrons they were cleaning. She didn't know why, but she could feel sweat running down her dress, even though it was a cool day, as if her body knew something it wasn't telling her mind. There was no movement from the midden pile, where the bright shorts and blouses of the children marked their passage. The commandant strode past without giving the dump a glance. Rivka hissed Hannah quiet and ran a finger across her own throat. The same signal that the peasants had made in the fields when the cattle cars passed them by. Hannah knew that signal. She just didn't know what it meant, exactly. She shivered. The commandant was a small, handsome man, so clean-shaven his face seemed burnished. His cheekbones had a sharp edge, and there was a cleft in his chin. He stopped for a moment in front of Hannah, Rivka, and Schifre. Hannah felt sweat run down her sides. The commandant smiled, pinched Rivka's cheek, then went on. Behind him was a man with a clipboard and a piece of paper. They walked without stopping again, straight to the far end of the compound. The door banged behind them ominously. Rivka let out a ragged breath and turned to Hannah. "Anyone who cannot get out of bed today will be chosen," she said. Her voice was soft, but matter-of-fact. "Chosen for what?" Hannah asked, though she'd already guessed. "Chosen for processing." "You mean chosen for death," Hannah said. Then suddenly she added, "Hansel, let out your finger, that I may see if you are fat or lean." "Do not use that word aloud," Rivka cautioned. "Which word?" asked Hannah. "Finger? Fat? Lean?" Rivka sighed. "Death," she said. "But why?" asked Schifre, her pale face taking color from the question. "Why will some be chosen?" "Because they cannot work," said Rivka. "And work..." Her voice became very quiet, and for the first time, Hannah heard a bitterness in it. "Because work macht frei." "And because he enjoys it," added Leah, coming over to see why they weren't working. "But do not let them hear you use the word death. Do not let them hear you use the word corpse. Not even if one lies at your feet," Rivka warned. "A person is not killed here, but chosen. They are not cremated in the ovens. They are processed. There are no corpses, only pieces of dreck, only schmattes, rags." "But why?" asked Hannah.
"Why?" Leah said. "Because what is not recorded cannot be blamed.
Because that is what they want, so that is how it must be. Quickly, back to work."
No sooner had they begun scrubbing again than the door to the hospital opened and Commandant Breuer emerged, still smiling, but broader this time. As he and his aide passed by, Hannah could see the paper on the clipboard was now covered with numbers and names. The commandant reminded her of someone, a picture perhaps, a moving picture. She'd seen a smiling face like that somewhere.
Dr. Mengele," she said suddenly. "The angel of Auschwitz."
As suddenly as she knew it, the reference was gone.
"No," Rivka said, puzzled. "His name is Breuer."
"Why did you say that?"
"I told you she says strange things," Schifre put in.
Hannah looked down at her hands. They were trembling.
"I don't know why I said it. Am I becoming a Muslim? Am I going mad?"
No one answered.
Gittel had been working in the sorting shed, where mountains of clothes and shoes, mounds of books and toys and household goods from the suitcases and bags were divided up. It was also the place where men and women could talk together, so there was a quick, quiet trading of information from the women's camp to the men's and back again. That night, Gittel shared the news with the others of the Tsugangi barracks. "All the clothes and shoes in good condition go straight to Germany, and we get what is left. But look what I took for you, Chayala." She held up a blue scarf.
"Organized. You organized it, Tante Gittel," Shifra cried out, her hands up with delight.
The women all laughed, the first time such a sound had rippled through the barracks since they'd arrived.
"Yes, she organized it."
Gittel looked up, pursed her lips for a moment, then smiled. "All right, I organized it."
"How did you do it, Gittel?"
someone called. "You can bet she didn't ask," came an answer. Gittel nodded, stretching the scarf between her hands. "As me freg da scheile is treif." Hannah translated mentally. "If you ask permission, the answer is no." She remembered suddenly another phrase from somewhere else, almost like it. "It's easier to ask for forgiveness than permission." She had a brief memory of it printed on something, like a shirt.
"So," said Esther's mother, a self-satisfied look on her face, "we may be Tsugangi, but we already know how to organize."
Esther looked longingly at the blue scarf and hummed quietly to herself. Gittel handed the scarf to Hannah.
"To replace the blue ribbons," she said softly.
"The blue ribbons?"
For a moment, Hannah couldn't remember them. Then she did.
"And because today is your birthday," Gittel added.
"Her birthday?" cried Shifra. "You didn't tell me."
Hannah shook her head. "My birthday is in the winter, in February." The words sat strangely on her mouth.
"What nonsense is this?" asked Gittel, her hands on her hips. "And what kind of word is February? They taught you to count the days by the Christian calendar in Lublin?"
She turned to look at the women who were circled around them.
"You think I don't know my own niece's birthday? And did I send a present every year?"
"Of course you know," a gray-haired woman called out. "I remember the day she was born," said another. "You told me in the synagogue, all happy with the idea. You were only 13, you said, and already an aunt."
"So," Gittel said, turning to face Hannah.
Her certainty overrode Hannah's own. Besides, she asked herself, who knew what day it was, what year in this place?
"Thank you, Gittel," she whispered. "It's the best present I've ever had, I think. The only one I remember, anyway."
"Oh, my dear child,"
Gittel said, pulling her close.
"Thank God that your father and mother are not alive to see you now."
Caught in Gittel's embrace, Hannah suddenly remembered the little house in the shtetl and the big embracing arms of Shmuel.
"What of Shmuel?" she said. "And Yitzchak, are they well?"
Gittel sat on a low shelf bed and pulled Hannah down next to her. The circle of women closed in, eager for news. Gittel nodded.
"Now listen. Shmuel is working with the crew that cuts wood, but it's all right. It's what he knows how to do, and he's strong. With him are Yitzchak the butcher, and Gedalia, and Natan Borodnik, and their cousin Nemuel. Tzadik, the cobbler, is doing what he's always done, making shoes and belts. They have a cobbler's shop there. He's making a fine pair of riding boots for the commandant, size 5.
"That's a woman's size," Esther's mother said with a laugh.
"Yes, and they've made up a little rhyme about it. Listen, I will tell it to you. Breuer wears a lady's shoe. What a cock-a-doodle-doo."
The women began to giggle.
Hannah didn't understand the humor.
Gittel held up her hand and the laughter stopped. And from Vyosk, Naftali the goldsmith is making rings on order for all the SS men. He is a very sick man, but they like his work so much, they're leaving him alone.
And where does he get the gold? Asked a woman in a stained green dress.
From the valises, idiot, someone else answered.
From our fingers, Faga said suddenly, the first time she'd spoken in days. She held up her hands so that everyone could see that they were bare.
From our ears.
From our dead, Gittel whispered. Hannah wondered whether anyone else heard her.
What about the others? Esther's mother asked.
I don't remember anything more, Gittel said softly.
What about the rabbi? Asked a woman with a hair lip. What about Rabbi Boruch?
Gittel didn't answer.
Faga knelt down in front of her, putting her hands on Gittel's skirt.
We are sisters, Gittel, she said.
I am your brother's wife. You must tell me about my father.
Gittel closed her eyes and pursed her lips. For a long moment she didn't speak, but her mouth opened and shut as if there were words trying to come out. At last she said,
Chosen. Yesterday. Baruch Dayan Emes.
Faga opened her mouth to scream. The woman in the green dress clapped her hand over Faga's mouth, stifling the scream, pulling her onto the sandy floor. Three other women wrapped their arms around her as well, rocking back and forth with her silent sobs.
Chosen,
Gittel said explosively, her eyes still closed.
Along with Tzadik the tailor, the Badchen, the butcher from Vyosk, and 24 others.
And the Rendar.
Why? Asked Hannah.
The rabbi was in the hospital. His heart was broken. Tzadik, too. He'd been beaten almost to death. The Badchen, because he chose to go. They say he said, This is not a place for a fool, where there are idiots in charge.
And the others, whose names I don't remember for crimes, I don't know.
And the Rendar.
With all his money, he couldn't buy his way out?
Asked Esther's mother. In this place, he is just a Jew, like the rest of us, said Gittel. Like the least of us.
He's a schmata now, said Hannah,
remembering Rivka's word.
Gittel opened her eyes and slapped Hannah's face without warning. That may be camp talk out there, but in here we say the prayer for the dead properly, like good Jews.
Gittel the bear, someone murmured.
Hannah looked up, hand on her smarting cheek. She couldn't find the speaker, so spoke to them all. Gittel is right, she said, her cheek burning.
Gittel is right.
Gittel began reciting the Kaddish, rocking back and forth on the sleeping shelf with the sonorous words, and the prayer was like the tolling of a death bell. The rest joined her at once. Hannah found she was saying the words along with them, even though her mind didn't seem to have any memory of the prayer. Yiskadal v'yiskadash shemei rabo.
This ends Disc 4.